Well, in order to make it complete, we do need one more foundation of mindfulness. We've had mindfulness of the body, and then we took the last one, the fourth one, mindfulness of the content of thought, and then mindfulness of the emotions, and we have one more, of the mindfulness of moods. It's called chitta nupassana, and which actually translated verbally would mean mindfulness of mind. But after many years of practice, it's become quite clear to me, mindfulness of mind, well, what you're going to do with that? It's the moods that we are in. Now again, one time more about the mindfulness. That is something not to forget. Without that, there is no path. It doesn't matter whether you know the four of this and the five of that and the seven of this and the eight of that or the 12 of this or the 13 or the 37, it really makes no difference. If you forget mindfulness, you have no spiritual path. And as far as mindfulness is concerned, yes, body of course, but the work is the changing of the unwholesome to the wholesome, in thought as well as in emotion. And as long as we identify with what we think and feel, it's difficult. It's very difficult to change it. Because as we identify, we think, I am that. Well, how am I going to change this, I am that? But it's not true. We are not that. We are something entirely different. We are actually all what we would like to be. We have the inner purity, we have the seed of enlightenment, we have clarity, we have all that. We have joy, we have peace, we just aren't aware of it. That's all. So this is the main aspect of practicing. Besides sitting on a little pillow. That's only a means. A main aspect is to know about oneself and change the unwholesome to the wholesome. It's only habit. And as we change our habits, we are a changed person. And we feel happier, of course. And the people around us feel happier. Because happiness is just as contagious as unhappiness. They're both very contagious. So one is a contagious disease, the unhappiness. And the other one is a benign influence. So we should choose wisely, all the time. And it's entirely up to us. We can't wait for somebody to have that benign influence on us. I mean, they're few and far between. We're better the ones to have the benign influence. The foundation of mindfulness, which is called chitta nupassana, and which is our moods, is easily explained, and it's also very helpful to become aware of in mindfulness, but it's a little more difficult. And yet, if we do become aware of our underlying moods, underlying tendencies which are expressed in our moods, and can already change that from the unwholesome to the wholesome, we don't have to start dealing with unwholesome thought or unwholesome emotion. Now there are people, innumerable people, who have an inherent tendency for negative moods. They just don't think things are right. Well, that's a true statement. Things aren't right, but there's no need to become negative about it. But some people have that as a tendency which they might have brought with them as a karma resultant. Or it may be a karma resultant of their habitual thinking. It can be anything. It doesn't matter. If we have that, we really need to do something about it. There are other people who have the inherent tendency, and I've mentioned that already, that their mood is quite happy and joyous, but it also gives them a wrong impression. Both things don't give the right impression. The negative tendency for the mood gives the impression as if everybody is really pretty difficult and life is difficult and one has to constantly shoulder the burden. And one also always looks for a scapegoat. It's very difficult not to look for a scapegoat. And of course there are some primary scapegoats which are very fashionable, particularly the mother and the teachers and God knows what else one thinks about. In some instances it's the church that becomes the scapegoat. Also not very useful. I mean, what do we need a scapegoat for? It's an inherent tendency of a negative mood. That's all it is. That's really all it is. And sometimes this inherent tendency for negative moods will result in depression, which is very extreme then. And as it results in depression, which means that we have really let go of trying to change it, it's more difficult to get out of. It doesn't have to result in depression. It can just result in dislike, rejection, unhappiness, worry. It usually, practically always, results in trying to prove oneself. To whom and as what? Whatever one has chosen. Whatever one has chosen as one's most important aspect in life, that one now has to prove that one is really good at it. And that's supposed to change that inherent negative mood that one lives in. It doesn't do a thing. It's very momentary. If somebody praises this, whatever we're doing, then we have a momentary change, but it doesn't change the underlying mood. Now then, the opposite, that joyous and happy mood, which can be extremely useful, also results in an extreme, which we have talked about when I talked about the mindfulness of content and the mindfulness of emotion. It results in the extreme of trying to believe that everything is just wonderful. Oh, we've talked about that already. Which is equal nonsense. Nothing is absolutely wonderful. I've said that already, other than the enlightened one. So that part of our extreme connection to things will never make it possible to see things as they really are. If we want to see things as they really are, we need to have a more equitable mood. We must be able to rely on our inner equilibrium so that we can actually harmonize within, so that we don't constantly have to look outside of ourselves. Now the person that is on that last extreme with a happy and joyful mood finds it easier to live, is easier to live with, but inside, very difficult. Very difficult to gain inside. Can usually do loving kindness very well, and not so much trouble with the jhanas, but insight, very difficult, extremely difficult. So we need to, if we want to, find out what our inherent basic mood is, really inquire into it and see how often do I have a mood which tells me everything is awful, and how often do I have a mood which tells me everything is fantastic? And both are wrong. Neither one of them have any basis in fact. Now, if we catch the mood before we start finding a cause for it, a reason — there is no cause or reason, it's just a mood — but before we actually make out a cause or a reason, we can change it right then and there to something which is at ease. It contains a sense of well-being. Things are the way they are, and that's fine. And if there's anything to be changed, it's only me. The rest, I can't change anyway. Everybody will have to do it themselves, if we talk about people. Our example might help sometimes. But if we try to be an example, I can assure you it doesn't work. That's a guarantee. If that what we do is an example, or the way we are, that's fine. But if we set out to be one, no. Because that, again, is so much caught up in our me identification that it can't possibly work properly. So here we have a mindfulness recognition which goes deeper than the content of thought and deeper than our emotions. It goes to that which is underlying both. And we need not look for a trigger. With our unwholesome thoughts and unwholesome emotions, we usually look for a trigger. And if we haven't practiced long enough, we blame the trigger. This is something that needs to be remembered. Again, if you don't remember all these fives, fours, nines, eights, it doesn't matter. But remember, don't blame the trigger. The trigger's got nothing to do with it. Has absolutely nothing. All it tells you, the trigger, is that it triggers something within. That's all it tells you. It does. It's not the one to blame. It's not at fault. It's got nothing to do with anything, actually, other than that the world has come near. Now, sometimes people can't deal with certain triggers. And without having tried to deal with them, they try to get rid of them. That's not the right way to do it. If one practices, one needs to first try and deal with the triggers. Deal with them in a way where one has compassion, love, helpfulness, all the positive emotions towards that unpleasantness. And if it then doesn't work, if one becomes negative over and over again, then the Buddha said, it's best to remove oneself from that trigger, but without blaming the trigger, with the understanding that one just hasn't grown enough in this practice in order to deal with that particular trigger. And one can go back to it later and deal with it, or not go back to it at all, but not to blame the trigger. If you remember that, don't blame the trigger, and you actually use it, you will know what goes on within you. Now, the unwholesome thoughts and the unwholesome emotions are not that difficult to recognize. And maybe if we let go of blaming or scapegoat, anything like that, we don't identify. And if we don't identify, we can change. But with the mood, it's a different story altogether. There's no trigger necessary. It just is. And very often it is like that from way back, since we were very, very small, without any cause or condition other than karmic resultant. So we have no trigger that we can find, other than we go look for it, of course. But by that time we have already started thinking unwholesomely or emoting unwholesomely. So if we want to avoid both of those, it's no use looking for any scapegoat. There's no reason for that underlying mood other than that it's there. And if we can catch that before we go a step further, which is very quick, and the mood is there, the thought, why it is so and what it is and all the rest of it, and the emotion comes very quickly. But when we really practice, we can go back to the mood and see it for what it is and realize that it has been the cause and the trigger for the thought and the emotion and change the mood. It's more difficult. It's more difficult to change that . But then there's no reason why we shouldn't try the more difficult things. None whatsoever. Everybody can do the easy things. People nowadays can do easy things when they're 4 and 5 years old. Press a button and you have the television going or the video going. No problem at all. But if we actually come to practice, we do need more difficult challenges. So we have that as our fourth foundation. In their proper order, as they are usually mentioned by the Buddha, the first one is mindfulness of the body, the second one, emotion, third one, moods, fourth one, content of thought. That's their proper order. I didn't use that order because I wanted to use it the way I felt was more useful. Now, again, we have here karmic resultants with which we have to deal and making karma. Every negative mood makes negative karma. And we are also, of course, faced with dealing with it because they're there. So there's nothing more important in one's own life than to deal with these things as quickly as one can. If we allow the mood to settle, very difficult to get rid of it. And most people allow the mood to settle because they've always done it. And as they've always done it, Of course, the thoughts and the emotions are there. And in equal measure and in the same way as the mood was there. If we realize that we need not identify with any of that, we can change it. If we identify with it, that's the way I am, or that's me, there's no way we can change it. The stronger the identification, the harder it is to change. If you look at it in an objective way, as an observer of what's going on, it's not so difficult to change. If we are the observer of the whole thing, So this is, or these are, the most important aspects of the first of the seven factors of enlightenment. Now, it isn't as if we hadn't mentioned in this time some of the other factors as they come up in the mindfulness, and particularly the second factor. The second factor of enlightenment is the inquiry into dhammas. Now here the word dhammas means phenomena. Inquiry into truth, into the phenomena. The second factor of enlightenment. Now, there's only one, there are only three things meant with inquiry into the dhammas. And they are anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and substancelessness, corelessness, no self. Now, we've talked about impermanence, quite a detailed and quite a lot, and I've talked about non-self, or substancelessness, corelessness, but we haven't taken a good look at dukkha yet. We've mentioned it, but it hasn't been in detail. And it's a very important subject. It's the Buddha's enlightenment statement, the Four Noble Truths, which he formulated under the famous Bodhi tree in what is now Bodh Gaya, after having sat there for a week in meditation, and then one day coming out of the jhanas and formulating the Four Noble Truths. They are, in telegram style, the whole teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And they deal with dukkha. So there we have one exposition of it. There's another mention of it, which is an important mention, and that is in the dependent origination, of which there are dozens of dependent originations. There's a whole section of the Samyutta Nikaya which is called the Samyutta Nidana. The Samyutta Nikaya is the, Nikaya means collection. And the Samyutta Nikaya is the collection of related subjects. Now obviously the Buddha didn't do that. It was all done later, so that one can find one's way through the Pali Canon a little easier, because it does consist of 17,500 discourses, so it's not that easy to find one's way through there. And eventually one has to. One has to know what is important and how it all fits together, which is not so easy with 17,500 discourses, but they do repeat themselves. So the Samyutta are a thematic collection, is the translation. It's collected together by themes. And one part of the Samyutta is the Samyutta Nidana. Nidana is dependent arising, or Nidana Samyutta. And so there are dozens of dependent originations. Not just one or two, but dozens of them. And sometimes the Buddha starts, as he usually does, with one particular point. Sometimes he starts, so to say, right in the middle, and sometimes he leaves out a few and puts his emphasis on a few more. So in that we find the dependent arising, which is nothing other than a very elaborate or more elaborate explanation of the Four Noble Truths. Dependent origination is elaboration on the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths is, so to say, the core, the kernel, and then dependent arising is the elaboration. Eventually one does need to know these things, but first one has to practice a bit, because otherwise one isn't interested. If one isn't practicing, one isn't going to be interested. Otherwise one is absolutely intellectual and wants to find out the whole intellectual part of the whole thing. But that doesn't help anybody. So the dependent origination, or the two dependent originations which are best known, because they're most often repeated, doesn't mean that they're more important than the others, is the worldly and the transcendent, Lokya and Lokutra. And with these two, we find a marked difference. It's very interesting that difference. The first one, the worldly dependent arising, which was briefly mentioned in one of the questions also, starts out with ignorance, goes through the whole rigmarole of what we experience day in and day out, and comes back to our own death. And underneath it is usually written, it's usually shown in a picture. It's a picture of a circle. And the circle, it's usually, in the Tibetan tradition, very colorful and interestingly designed. And underneath it usually says, and this is how the whole dukkha arises. From ignorance, through that whole rigmarole of rebirth and craving and clinging and becoming and then dying again. So it is a circular motion. And where does the circle lead us? Nowhere. It always goes back to the circle, doesn't it? It doesn't go anywhere. Always round and round and round. Which is another reason why we can go in this world, in this little planet of ours, anywhere. It's round. We're always going to come back to where we are anyway. It doesn't have to be physically, but in here. Circles don't lead us anywhere. But the transcendental dependent arising, Lokutra, is the one that goes in a straight line. It's not shown as a circle. And it starts out with dukkha. And it ends with Nibbana. And again, it's a very exact and very detailed elaboration of the Four Noble Truths. So we'll have a look at that aspect. Now, it starts out with dukkha. Why? People who haven't heard the Buddha's teaching before, or haven't heard much of it, are apt to say, and one can't really blame them for that, that, oh, that's a very negative teaching. It's all about dukkha. It's all about suffering. Well, of course, they don't translate dukkha as unsatisfactory. It's usually translated as suffering. So people say, oh, very, very negative. No, don't want to have anything to do with that. I've got enough dukkha as it is. I don't want to hear about it. Oh, well. Okay. Well, that's the end of that one. We don't go any further. Don't want to hear about it? Okay. Now, if you then have the misfortune to listen to somebody like me, you will hear about it. And there are some explanations which will show quite clearly that the Buddha did not have suffering in mind when he was explaining it in order to make people suffer. He had exactly the opposite in mind. He had exactly in mind that to talk about dukkha would eventually show people how to get out of it. And that's all that's really important. He said, there's only one thing I teach, and that's suffering and how its end to reach. That's dukkha and how its end to reach. It's only one thing I teach. So every method, everything we've talked about, all the contemplations, all the mindfulness, everything that you may remember or not remember, it all has only one goal, one direction, to recognize dukkha and to eventually get out of it. Now the recognition of dukkha, and this is the most important part to start out with, is, so to say, the necessary entry for going on a spiritual path. I mean, why else do I want to prove to my neighbors that I'm so spiritual, or to my family, or is everything else boring, so I'm going to have some entertainment, or I have my friends said it's very good to meditate, so now I'm going to meditate. None of these are sufficient reasons to keep it going. They might be sufficient reasons to give it a go and then do something else, which happens often enough. Of the thousands of people who do take a meditation course, one can count the people who continue with it. You can't count the thousands because there are thousands of them everywhere, but those that really do it, you can count them. And the only reason that one will really do it is one knows I have dukkha. That's the only reason why one will do it. Now there's another sort of tail end to that sentence, which is necessary. I know I have dukkha, and I know that I've tried all worldly aspects and possibilities to get out of it, and nothing worked. It's all short-lived. It's all sensual pleasure through the senses. Now, if one doesn't have that tail end, one is undoubtedly going to try all sorts of other things. Travel, Tai Chi, crystals, what else is going at the moment? I have no end to this stuff. I haven't read any of these magazines lately, so I'm not so well up on it. No end what one can try. Oh, a new relationship, of course. That's always very, very fashionable. Any time, always. The same in the Buddha's time. It hasn't changed. I mean, that was 2,500 years ago, the same thing. There was he had a cousin. His name was Nanda. Not Ananda, but Nanda. And Nanda couldn't make up his mind whether he was going to get married or whether he was going to be a monk. So finally his parents got sick and tired of this dilly-dallying around and arranged the marriage for him. And the Buddha was invited as a guest of honor. And so then he had his meal. And then he said to Nanda, "Nanda, come and carry my alms bowl back for me to the monastery." And of course, you know, it was very difficult for Nanda to say no. So he did, he carried. And when he got halfway, he said to the Buddha, "Well, how long is it? You know, I've got to get back there. I'm getting married." And the Buddha said, "It doesn't matter. I'll wait for you. Come on." And so they kept going. And again he asked, and again he was told the same thing. And then when they finally got to the monastery, the Buddha said to him, "Why do you want to get married?" And he said, "Oh, a very beautiful woman, and I really love her, and she's really a wonderful person." The Buddha said, "Well, if you stay in the monastery and really practice, you can meet easily 500 that are far more beautiful and far more wonderful." And Nanda said, "Really? Is that so?" And the Buddha said, "Yep." So so Nanda stayed. And every once in a while I went to the Buddha and said, "Well, where are these 500 beautiful women?" The Buddha said, "Well, I told you to practice, didn't I?" So he kept on practicing. And well, of course, when he finished practicing, he didn't need 500 beautiful women anymore. So we have exactly the same thing then as we have now. And the Buddha said, in that connection, it doesn't matter why we come to the practice. Well, Nanda evidently came for the wrong reasons. He wanted 500 beautiful women. But he said it didn't matter, as long as we come and really practice. So if we have gained enough understanding, and it does take some years to be, years of life and being enmeshed in the ordinary daily activities, that one sees that there is dukkha in me, and in the world they don't have any remedy for that. I've tried the most obvious ones and they didn't work, and one isn't willing to try new ones. Or one can't think of any new ones. It's also a good reason. Some people can think of new ones all the time. But if one has lost the imagination and lost the willingness to look for the relief of dukkha in the world, then one is ready to practice. And so this is actually the very first step on this transcendental dependent arising, that one understands one's own dukkha. And one understands it as deeply and as profoundly as is possible. One of the dukkha things that people very rarely understand within themselves is restlessness. They can't keep at one thing. They always have to do something else. That's that inner restlessness, because there isn't enough joy, inner joy, enough peace. Now, restlessness only disappears completely for the Arahant. So you can see how ingrained that is. Always something else, something different. It gets greatly helped when our meditation comes together to the point of the absorptions. Because then we can let go of restlessness for the time of meditation and relate to that state of not being restless, at least in the mind. If we haven't got that to fall back on, restlessness remains. And that restlessness, it becomes less as we have past moments, but that restlessness also makes us look for scapegoats. There aren't any. There are no scapegoats anywhere. Dukkha is the first noble truth, and this is very important. I mean, they are the core and essence of the Buddha's teaching, but it's not important because of that or in that way. It's important to remember it, to know it, that all existence is dukkha. Now, when we are able to accept that and to see it in an objective way, we don't have to suffer from it. I mean, just the way it is. Existence is dukkha. There's always something that is changing and therefore creates friction. Things that change create friction. There's always something that could be better. Rarely does an ordinary person have a feeling of fulfillment, if ever. At least very rare. There's always something that could be other. It could be shorter or longer. It could be hotter or colder. It could be more or less. It could be more pleasant. It could be more beautiful. There's always something. That inner feeling of total fulfillment escapes everyone. Only the enlightened one has it. So even the non-returner one step before enlightenment still has restlessness, which shows how ingrained that is. So that dukkha that we have to recognize does not mean that we are faced with a tragedy. We can be, but it doesn't mean that. It can mean that too. And it doesn't mean that we have a life-threatening illness, or that we've just lost a lover, or anything like that. It doesn't mean any of these. It means that inner feeling of being not fulfilled, not totally at ease, always hoping for something more and better, trying to find out how to get it, that inner yearning for something which we can't actually name. We have tried, humanity has tried to name it. I've given it all sorts of names and made that into traditional dogma into which one should adhere. One has in the past, one doesn't seem to at the present. One has made that into, for instance, paradise, heaven, anything like that. These are just words. In order to get that, give a name to the inner yearning, which is the unfulfillment, the lack of being totally sure and clear.